From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Brought to you, as always, by our wonderful sponsors at PumpCheck Dataworks. Joining me again, I have to welcome, first of all, the captain himself, Charles Morgan.
Hello, Grant. How very, very nice to hear your voice.
Great. Likewise, it's good to see you. The viewers, thankfully for them, can't see either of us, but we can see each other. And we can also see our third co-host, the inimitable Roger Mitchell.
Hi, Grant. I was glad to have you back. As you heard in the last episode, Giles and I missed you greatly. So wonderful that you're back.
It wasn't the same. It wasn't the same. It just wasn't.
This was one, even though I didn't have the choice, I was ostracized from the last one. But this one I didn't want to miss because our guest today is someone that I've been a fan of for a long, long time. I think he's one of the best journalists covering football, particularly in the world today. And Roger, I'm going to leave you to introduce our guest to the listeners.
Yeah, today we've got Gabriele Marcotti, will be known to most people. Gabriele has lived in various countries in the world, and I think that's one of his attractions to us today. He's lived in Italy, the States, UK, and also in Asia. And I think because of that, he's one of the true global commentators in the sports industry. Most rightly so are local. And if you take the example of Barstow, they start from a local market like Boston. Gab would be the opposite of that. And his perspective because of that is so, so interesting. And you know, we're in an amazing time. And I couldn't think of anybody better to give us a little bit of that wisdom to take us through 2021.
Absolutely echoed from this particular chair in the Cayman Islands. Well, let's without any further ado, bring in Gab, shall we?
Thanks for joining us, Gab. Great to have your time and a crucial moment for the whole football and sports industry. Lovely to see you.
It's a privilege. Thanks for having me on. And I hope to learn a lot from our conversation today.
I'll introduce you to that man there, Grant Williams, and with him is Giles Morgan. It's the three of us that inhabit the tavern, as it were.
The three musketeers, yeah. We like to
the
think
three musketeers. Great to have you with us. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Grant, and great to meet you guys.
What I wanted to ask you at the start, Gab, is this a simple one to just get to know you a little bit better. How come the Paul Robeson profile picture? What's that all about?
Paul Robeson. Well, it's funny. Well, first of all, I'm impressed that you recognize him and know who he is. A lot of people look at it and say, oh, why do you have a picture of a fat Tiger Woods? Others have suggested that it was Jeremy Guskett. I don't know. I was always fascinated by Paul Robeson. Because going back to when I was sort of made to read a biography of him, and there have been hundreds, back when I was, I think, 12 or 13 years old, and I had to read it for school, and I thought, wow, like, this guy was actually really good at a bunch of different things, and he wasn't, and obviously some things were precluded to him because of the conditions and his race and whatever, but he still made it big, and I sort of got to thinking. And I don't want to give away my age here, but it was, you can probably guess it was some point in the 1980s. I said, if he was alive today, how would his life have panned out differently? Like, would he have continued with sport? Would he have gone into something else? Would he have taken an more active political role? Would he just be, you know, Lionel Richie or whatever? And so that's kind of, that was kind of my thing. And I've just been fascinated by him for a long time. And so I figured it would make for an interesting talking point on Twitter if I had that rather than my ugly mug here.
Mission accomplished, obviously. You even got a Scotsman fascinated by it, which is great. Yeah, obviously, we're all giving our ages away here, but the 1980s, talking about kind of someone like Robeson, who was such a threat in so many different areas of talent. I mean, he was an extraordinary guy. And in the 80s, for me, that guy in the sporting field was Bo Jackson. You know, Bo Jackson was, I mean, I think to this day, the most extraordinary athlete I think I've ever seen in my lifetime. Was he someone that was on your radar screen that you followed closely, or was he just a peripheral figure?
So you're giving something away too, because if you say Bo Jackson was the most extraordinary athlete in your lifetime, then that certainly means that you're not old enough to have witnessed Jim Thorpe. And of course, neither am I.
Only in film, yeah, only in film.
But no, well, you know, it's funny because I grew up I grew up around the world because of my dad's job. And so I was largely sort of formative years between 12 and 15. I was in Tokyo, and younger listeners won't believe this, but there was no internet back then. There was very limited television. So you read these things called magazines, which I think are, I don't,
I've, I'm not, I've heard of them. Yeah.
I'm not sure they exist anymore. So you would read magazines and newspapers, and you wouldn't get many. But if you were a voracious reader and you like sport, like I was at the time, I read everything cover to cover. I didn't think I could get my hands on back then. And, you know, you go to, it was like an English library with English text and stuff. So I sort of tracked the whole evolution of Bo Jackson, and I followed American sports much more closely back than I do now, with one exception. I was shocked by that, by sort of his ability. The idea of playing multiple sports is much more common in the U.S., obviously, although that's changing now, and some say not for the better, than in Europe. You know, Bo Jackson could probably have played professionally in two sports, probably could have played professionally in three sports. Probably could have been an Olympian, but yeah, without question, that sort of multi-talented quality that he brought, the idea that, you know, you're an athlete first, and then you can learn the skills, right? If you have hand-eye coordination, if you have the right element, you can learn most sports. You know, that's one of those themes that I know everybody will disagree on it, and, you know, nature versus nurture and whatever, but the building block is always athletes. And I always like to, I'm always fascinated by this. And I speak to, when I meet sort of fit to football clubs, I often ask them, I'm like, okay, so goalkeepers excluded, if you take the worst athlete in your team, is there anybody who would not be in the top 1 or 2% of the population? And unfailingly, to a man, virtually everybody in their age group would be in the, you know, in the 99th percentile, 98th percentile of the population. We don't quite realize that. And then this is in terms of measuring, of measurables, right? Of things that, of natural gifts. So that's why on the nature versus nurture debate, I am way, way over to the nature side. And I think the whole 10,000 hours and, you know, Gladwell, that part of it is just so much so many things that we like to tell ourselves because, you know, they make us feel good, but I don't know how you guys feel about it, but it's nonsense, I think.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Gladwell, so I think he's just an absolute genius. But I think your point to me, I completely agree with it. I think that's what makes it so extraordinary when we see a Tiger Woods, when we see a Bo Jackson, when we see a Michael Jordan, that you can be that much better than the top 1 or 2% of athletes. You know, I think that's the attraction of these superstars in sport, is that I think on a subliminal level, we do realize that they're all elite athletes, but then these guys come along who are just outliers, and it's just breathtaking to watch in any discipline.
Yeah, and perhaps I think maybe that's where it holds weight, right? In the sense that maybe if there is a merit to the 10,000 hours, that is what separates Tiger Woods from, you know, some other elite a golfer. But this idea that you or I could spend 10,000 hours of deliberate practice from a young age, I mean, forget about it.
Gab, I'm interested talking about the media side of things, which is sort of related to the 10,000 hours. You know, you grew up in a time when journalism was a respected profession that took many years to hone. And now we live in a world of content, of the ability to, everybody can be a broadcaster. Look at that. Look at us. We're all broadcasting away. And yet, I wonder what you see the role of sports journalism is, because it seems to me if journalism is the power to tell stories, and we look back at the Norman Mailers of this world and people who evoke such extraordinary pictures of the past, of what sport used to be and how it was conveyed, the Lions tours in rugby in the 70s, you know, only few people turned up for those, but my goodness, the legend's gone forever. What do you see the future role of sports journalism for people like yourselves who've been doing it for many years?
That's a really good question. And I just give you a minute to think about the answer. I mean, the first instinct, when you bring up the, if I could just address the past first, there's a colleague of mine named Jonathan Wilson, who's this sort of very serious, very deliberate. He writes for The Guardian now. He's written books about tactics, about many different things. And he read, I'm not going to name him, but there's a very respected English journalist who's, I think, has now passed, who wrote a book about World Cup history, which is like the definitive book. And he wrote about the 62 and 66 and 70 World Cups and whatever. And it is like the definitive tome, and it's very well written and everything. And because Jonathan has time on his hands, and especially because he's very meticulous, he went back, and the book sort of narrates almost every game at these World Cups. And he went back and he found the YouTube clips to everything. And then he kind of took a liking to it because he's done it with many other famous match reports, many other bits of writing from the 70s and 80s and even the 90s. And he juxtaposed the description of the writer at the time with what actually happened, what we can see on the YouTube clip. And you know where this is going. A lot of the time, the description has no bearing whatsoever on reality. Obviously, television brings this to a very different level. The fact that today, you know, people obviously watching on television back then most of the time anyway, but the difference, obviously, you don't have replay, you don't have YouTube, you can't rewatch the clip, you can't make it big, you can't zoom in, you can't zoom out. You can't be descriptive because obviously by the time you produce your copy, you know, everybody's seen it. If you can be a brilliant writer, you know, you mentioned Norman Mailer there, that's great. If somebody took, you know, the Norman Mailer equivalent of today, whether you think it's, you know, Amitabh Ghosh or whoever, right? You go and you send this guy and have him report on a match once a year. It's going to cost you a ton of money, the way it probably cost Norman Mailer a ton of money back then. And it'll probably, you know, it won't get the audience. Even we've tried it. People do that, right? Get great writers to write about it. It just doesn't have the same audience because those are storytellers. The storytelling aspect of an event, I think, is largely gone. I know there's some who disagree with it. There's obviously documentary filmmakers who go back and interview everybody, but and then go behind the scenes and, oh, this is the real story of why this and that happened. And there are situations when that's very well written. But I don't know, a lot of times people are so trained to reflect and to be introspective on what they've been through that I think you lose a lot of the immediacy and a lot of the authenticity of what made it great at the time.
So do you think sport is the poorer for that, that technology, that the nowness, if you like, of communication means that we've lost something along the way?
We've definitely lost that literary aspect to it. And there's a part of me that says, okay, so we've lost a lot of fiction writers. You know, I mean, I'm not saying these people are making everything up, but the way something is experienced, you know, by nature, if I'm talking about a match or if I'm writing about it, even if I'm filing on deadline, I get a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth look at what happened. And I have a duty to contextualize it because I know my viewers will have had that. I can't simply describe it, right? So I can't just go and follow my whim and, you know, and say Zlatan Ibrahimovic flew through the air to head the ball like some Tyrannosaurus Rex, because it might not have happened. It might not, you know, you know what I'm saying? Like, you can't build it that way.
Sure.
I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, you go back I moved to England sort of around the end in October of 1996. And you can look in the broadsheets then, and you can read these long match reports, and you're wondering, was this guy watching the game? Was this how he imagined the game in his mind? You know, and you compare them with today, and they're all written very differently. That side of it, I think, is gone. I think one of the big challenges, I think where there's always room, is there's room for critical thinking. There's room for analysis. There's room for contextualizing things. And what I found also is that while a lot of the decision makers and leaders don't like talking in front of a microphone or on camera, they often realize it's in their interest to speak to you on background. And so that's what I try to do. And I try to contextualize based on that. So there's room for that. Beyond that, the other stuff, you know, profiles are often so closely controlled by the clubs or by the gatekeepers. I don't see how interesting they are. Interviews are good if they have something to say and if they want to get a point across. A lot of what passes for news reporting today is basically, you know, clubs all employ PR people whose literal job it is to talk to you on background, right? Not just clubs. I mean, government does it too, especially in the UK. You know, I was always taught that you don't quote a spokesman anonymously. You're a spokesman by very nature. You might use your information for background if you're speaking off the record, but I'm not going to give you the luxury anonymous quote. Now, it happens daily in political coverage, and it happens a lot, I think, in news reporting too, which, you know, it's a different kind of journalism. And I think as long as you know where it's coming from and why somebody's telling you things a certain way, I think you can still navigate through it.
Okay, let me ask you, because this is, I'm just drinking every word of this in because it's so fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And it's something that I've thought so long and so hard about for so many years. And something you said back there really resonates with me, this idea of storytelling. Because when I look at sport, it is the most perfect and potentially fertile ground for storytelling, because every game is a story, every career is a story, every fan experience is a story, and we are so emotional about it, and we go back home and we tell the story of our experience at the game, and we tell the story of what we saw. And yet, to your point, there's this desire, particularly with obviously match reports, which are much more factual. This is what happened, the goal was scored in that minute, the guy got sent off there, here's what we think. Do you think that this element of storytelling can get a foothold again? We're seeing it with things like The Athletic, where they really are taking the time to write beautiful stories about particular aspects. Does that have a future, do you think? I like to believe it does. It may be a niche, but I think there's a very strong future for it. Or is it going to get drowned out by the short-term immediate, I want the facts, I want them now, I want the highlights?
So first of all, I hope 100% that The Athletic succeeds. And I hope I don't get in trouble here, but if there's one person in English media who I blame for ruining things, and who I would probably physically slap around, or no, metaphorically slap around if I ever met him, it's Alan Rusbridger, the former editor of The Guardian, who, of course, was the first to take all the content and just dump it online. Information wants to be free, all this democratizing nonsense. We saw what that happened. That led to a big lack of quality. I worked for The Times when we went behind the paywall, and I think it's great that The Athletic have done it, because if the model succeeds, Even from the perspective of, I mean, right, you can say this is just sport, right? But if you think about it, right, the advertising supporting model is a horrendous one from a public trust, public interest perspective, right? Yep. Whose interests are better served? 100,000 like-minded people spending 10 euros a month or whatever it is on a subscription, or, you know, half a dozen or a dozen big advertisers supporting it through ads. Which eventually, by Amen. The way, as people become savvy, as everybody knows, nobody clicks on. I mean, Amen. I don't know the last time any of you guys clicked on an ad for anything online, right? So that out of the way, the storytelling that The Athletic does, it's I think it's useful. I don't know how big the audience is. I think I want the audience for it to be big. I want people to enjoy the writing. I want people to immerse themselves in that. And I'm glad it's there. And then, you know, they're not the only long form people who are doing that.
Do you think there's also a danger? I'm a marketing guy, right? So probably the devil. But it seems to me that some of the real allure of sport is that the way that the history of the sports of the old reporting was that the myths and legends are created. If everything is short form, if everything is immediacy, if everything is controlled by the PR people, if everything is glib, does that tarnish sport itself fundamentally? Are we in danger of the immediacy of sport actually ruining the mythology of what it's supposed to be, which is, I'm a huge advocate that our listeners know of Simon Barnes when he used to write for The Times and others. Yeah. I always felt that he got to the nub of why sport mattered, largely because sport doesn't matter, and therefore that's what makes it very special. Do you think there's a danger that sport becomes too commoditized and packaged?
I think it's obviously a risk, right? And obviously clubs have talked about this, but I'm not sure it's that. I agree with you. There is an evolution to it. And I think sport will, as an entertainment vehicle, will continue to serve different audiences. One part will be that long-form audience, that storytelling audience, those people who read the 3,000-word pieces in The Athletic. You know, my favorite magazine is The New Yorker. I think most of their stories run to 3,000 to 5,000 words anyway, and I'll read them. I mean, I read a story about the ecology around the Rio Grande and how it might be impacted by the wall if Trump ever builds one, which I guess won't happen now. But and I have no interest in these issues. But it's just great writing, great storytelling, and I read it and I enjoyed it and I was richer for it. So I think there is a constituency of that. But I think the storytelling, I think there's another sort of participatory quality to being a sports fan. As you probably know, the single biggest driver in any media company when it comes to football is transfer stories, for example, right? And yeah, there was just this insatiable appetite for it. I used to cover the transfer market. I don't anymore. But and you realize, and people are so into this, and they get tremendous numbers. And in a way, this is a form of storytelling too, in the sense that people imagine what might happen. They feel they're in the middle of some sort of unfolding saga, which will lead to their team signing, you know, player X, who will then lead them on to something. There's something very aspirational. There's something wanting to know, even though when you think about it and take a step back rationally, you know, half these guys the team are going to be linked with are going to be foreign players that nobody's ever heard of. Although then you can go on a discovery now as well. You could look them up on YouTube. You know, can you research what kind of player is he? It's much more engaged than it was in the 70s and 80s. You know, players changed teams back then too, but you didn't have that same sense. Can you maintain the storytelling in shorter form? I mean, that's a good question. I would assume a very talented filmmaker could. I don't know if you're familiar with the Copa 90 videos.
Yeah.
A lot of those are short and there's real storytelling going on. I guess Quibi, is it the platform in the US tried
Quibi,
to
yeah.
do they short feature it. Films? Yeah, that didn't quite work out, but obviously that's television fiction. I don't know. I'm less concerned about that. I also kind of wonder, I know we always look at the past with, you know, rose tinted glasses, but you know, okay, so I'll mention Simon since you brought him up. But in the 1970s or 1980s, let's say, your family probably might have gotten one or two newspapers a day, and that is really the only sports content that you were going to digest. Maybe a little bit on the radio or whatever, but that's it. And so you had to read Simon Barnes or whatever the Simon Barnes equivalent of the 70s and 80s was. And also I might add, you know, I don't know Simon's background offhand, But I'm assuming if Simon was writing for the Mirror or the Sun at the time, if he ever did, he wasn't writing the kind of pieces he was writing for the Times. So this idea that everybody was engaged in this wonderful storytelling in the British Lions tour, I don't know. I you'd have to go back and look up the archives. You know, like I remember reading a book about I'm not a cricket guy, but I was fascinated by the whole Bodyline series and whatever. Well, you know, were those 300 word dispatches from Down Under, or was everybody reading the, you know, 2,500 word profiles about the tension, and, you know, was it Peter Jardine or whatever his name was? You know, like I have serious questions about that too. You know, inevitably, I think more educated elites are going to remember the more educated elite type stuff, whereas maybe the majority of the population was consuming something totally different.
Gab, this kind of like absolute reality that you're giving us is what I was hoping that we would get. And there's something I want to segue into now. Football has seen linking to media, the whole Leeds United story. And, you know, on this podcast, we talked about tribal and tribes and how tribes behave. I saw a tweet of yours when I was like getting ready for this. You said you don't know what's more tribal, politics or football. What do you believe that people have a misunderstanding of what the beast football is? And if they do, is that ever going to change?
I think, yeah, I mean, that was a tweet where I was just asking about. I think in some ways, the way we experience football has become, for some people, and some of them, and this is purely anecdotal, just based on my social media feeds, I might even wonder if it's a lot of people from parts of the world, not Western Europe, who maybe aren't steeped in football history the way we are over here. But this idea that you're loyal to a team, and so you have to be loyal to the people who run the team, until you're not, until everybody agrees that they have to go. That's the part which sometimes I find extremely, extremely off-putting, and extremely disappointing, and sometimes even scary, because I said, you know, all right, it's one thing, you know, if you believe Juventus or Man City have never done anything wrong in their histories and never will, and those people are saints. But it's a short step between that and thinking that, you know, the great cult leader is like that too, when you thoroughly embrace the idea, you know, thinking you're taking the red pill, but instead you're taking the idiot pill. That, and you know, that's something I see, and I'm a bit concerned about. I was always basing myself on the premise that the people who own and run football clubs are, I always mention the fancy Swiss brand, I think it was Patek Philippe, was it? Or maybe it's Piaget, I don't know. But basically they said, like, you never actually own one of their expensive watches, Patek you simply Philippe. Look after it.
Yeah, Patek Philippe.
You simply look after it for another generation. That should be the ethos of a club, right? And a fan's loyalty should be to the colors and the badge and nothing else. Not to the players, not to the owner, certainly not to the owner. And you should judge everything on its merit. And yet you see this, right? And this goes beyond the tribalism of disliking another team. And I mean, it's this idea. And I almost feel like this is a pretty new thing. Fierce rivalries and tribalism have been around in football forever. But I always thought, you know, you never had this fealty to the people who were running the clubs. I remember actually the first time I went to Glasgow, and I went to an Old Firm derby, and I ran into a bunch of Rangers fans who were not very pleasant. Pleasant people in some ways. I mean, you can imagine what the discourse was like. But they were hugely critical of David Murray at a time when, who was the I guess the owner or the chief executive or it was the chairman.
The owner,
like,
yeah.
The owner, right?
Yeah, he was the owner.
Spent a lot of money or whatever. And this is before they knew what was going to happen, obviously. And I thought, this is the right attitude. You know, you should always question the people who are running us. Are they doing the right things for my club? That, if you will, is a healthy tribalism. I mean, going back to your original question about politics versus sport, if you assume that you're not going to change your fandom, you can't do anything about it. Obviously, it's more worrying when politics becomes tribal, right? Because that means that you can never change your mind about anything. If we start treating our political allegiances, especially allegiances to parties or people, the same way we treat our footballing allegiances, then, you know, there's no debate, there's no dialogue, there's nothing. It'll just be echo chambers of repeating the same stuff and talking at cross purposes.
It's such a wonderful point, Gav. It really is. And I think what you said there about the loyalty being to the club, the badge and the colours is true. And I think that's the way most football fans, certainly if you ask British football fans who've grown up in Britain and Italian fans who've grown up in Italy, that is the loyalty. Obviously, it's slightly different, I think, in many ways for fans out in Asia, for example, who have only really been exposed to the Premier League in the last, let's call it, 20 years or so. And that's their allegiances have kind of grown up in this era. But in a way, that's the problem, because I think the frustration for fans is, as we know on this, as we have this conversation today, I'm a Fulham fan. I don't have a choice. That's my team. So whatever the owner does, yes, I'm going to get frustrated, but I can't decide to go and support Chelsea or Liverpool. I just don't have that option, you know? So the frustration that boils up when you realize that what's being done to my club, my team, my colors, whatever it may be, the tribalism stems, I think, from this almost kind of beautiful hopelessness that you have as a fan, because you can never change your colors.
And the fact that, you know, when the Khan family move on, and one day, presumably, they probably will, you'll still be there if you're still alive. And if you've passed it on to your children, they'll still be there, right? The fans will always be there. The owners will come and go. You know, the owner of Juventus, Andrea Agnelli, loves talking about how, well, my family, we have to hold the world record for continuously owning the same club. Okay, except for them, everybody else, all these people pass, and the club is still there. And I think a fan's first duty should be, you know, not to defend them and the club and their actions mindlessly, always and everywhere, but to hold them to account, because these guys aren't running your local restaurant. You know, these guys are running something that means a lot to a lot of people, you know, and I'm always surprised by that. That people don't seem to wrap their head around it. You know, yeah, we talk about them as brands, but obviously they're the kind of brands that you don't switch, you know? That's the big difference. And so, you know, I mean, Roger, with all the time you spent in Italy, you'll know this happened more before, but it still happens. You know, people acquire football clubs for a song to become popular locally because, you know, they like the sound of 10,000 people singing their name. It's as simple as that. You know, that's why they did it.
So, Gab, let me ask you then on that. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and goodness knows we're not out of it yet by a long chalk. There's a global economic downturn, the like of which probably humanity has never seen. And private equity and private money is licking its lips, as there's a lot of distressed assets in sport across the board who are going to struggle to survive. And you can see that money is going to be coming in. From what you're saying then, do you think there's going to be, in a sense, there's almost dark times coming, because there's going to be a lot of owners who are thinking about the commercial imperative and not the fan, and that in 15 years' time, we're going to be left with an even more barren landscape because a lot of those investors may have decided to part company. I'm fascinated. Is this a moment in time, pre-investment, that could see some even more torrid times in a decade or so?
So, and I know a lot of owners will disagree with me when I say this, but I think we're definitely in a moment of tremendous flux. And, you know, somebody said to me, there probably won't be a breakaway European Super League in our lifetimes, but if there is, it's going to happen in the next 12 to 18 months, right? That's how big the stakes are with the FIFA calendar changing and whatever. But I also want to say this about sport. This is a business. And again, I haven't been an entrepreneur in many different fields, but I would assume there aren't that many fields where 60 to 70% of your costs are labor costs. And if they are labor costs, you know, they're not the kind of labor costs where you're stuck with these people until retirement because of labor laws. I mean, think about running a football club. At every football club, I mean, if you're well run, it's 50%. And if you're less well run, it's 60, 70, 80. Some clubs, it's like 130%, but whatever. This is your biggest cost, is labor. And every year, a quarter to a third of that labor cost, their contracts come up. And if you can't afford to keep them, you don't extend them. And on top of that, you have another luxury. You can also actually sell your players. Imagine that. You can sell your employees and get money back for them if they're good enough. So this should make football incredibly, incredibly resilient if it's well managed, if it's properly managed, if there's proper oversight. I don't buy into this idea of people crying poverty. I don't buy into this idea of investment to build for the future, because you know what? The fans will still be there. You know, you may not grow into a club capable of contending for the Champions League or whatnot, but you know, you shouldn't go bust if you run your club properly and if there is proper oversight. There should be that solidity there. That is always what gets me and what I find difficult to understand. We heard earlier this year, the European Clubs Association, you know, they came out and they gave their scenario, their projected losses for the 2019-20 season and 2020-21. And it's all doom and gloom. And they say, we're going to lose about, you know, 4 billion euros in revenue over those two seasons. And I thought about it and I looked at the total number and I say, okay, you're losing about less than 10% a season. You're going back to 2018 levels. You know, everybody's taking a hit. You know, cry me a freaking river. And, you know, and I'm not making fun. This is the thing about football. These are entrepreneurs. They carry with them entrepreneurial risk. And if they had invested in a copper mine, or if they had invested, you know, in a chain of car washes, they would have run these same risks. And yet, because it's football, we're supposed to all of a sudden make allowances. I'll tell you one other thing. The clubs who are losing the most money are the clubs who get the biggest gate receipts and the biggest TV income anyway, right? So there's actually the biggest, best placed clubs to weather the storm. Obviously, I know, obviously lower down, there's no gate receipts and they don't make any other money, so they're taking a hit. I completely agree with that. And I think it's important that we do everything to make sure clubs don't go bust. But again, that's when you ask yourself a question. How many professional clubs does a country need? If you're talking about, you know, me feeling sorry for a conference club that's in, that, you know, can't afford to play their reserve right back £200 a week, I say, well, hey, how about you do it the way you did it 20 years ago? And get an amateur to play there for free. You know, do you become less of a community club if you don't at that level, if you don't have professional players? So I don't know. Maybe I'm just too drilled in the market's ability to correct itself if we let it do its thing. But I don't have a lot of sympathy for club owners who cry poverty. You know, you benefited from the tremendous rise in football, globalization and commercialization that's happened in the last 15 years. And now you and your players can take a hit, certainly at the top level.
Gab, let's continue on that, because today we've got probably the most obvious signal that the Super League is imminent. It probably would have happened by now if it wasn't for maybe Infantino wondering what politics he wants to go for in terms of getting rid of UEFA. There's a whole political story here that maybe we don't have time to really analyse, but I want to come back to your previous point about these owners. And what I'll tell you, what I'll say to you is this. In football, their objective is clear. They want to eliminate volatility. They want to eliminate the risk of going down or not qualifying for the Champions League. And they want to run a business exactly as you have set out. They will have, as in America, they will have the wage cost maybe at 50%. No chance of a drop in revenues because it's all guaranteed. And I will suggest, for your opinion, that they are about to get there with the help of what Giles has just said, the big money guys. And I think football is about to change dramatically right under our noses in 2021.
I mean, that's certainly a scenario. And, you know, if we're talking, obviously, you know, as we're recording this, FIFA and the six confederations have put out a joint statement reminding everybody that if it's whatever you're thinking of setting up, if it's not sanctioned by your local confederation, then anybody who plays in it will get banned. And by the way it's been reported, it's, oh, you just get banned from the World Cup and the Euros. Now, theoretically, there's no reason they can't go and tap, say, the FA on the shoulder and say, hey, those clubs participating in the Super League, they can't play in the Premier League. And you, England, if you don't put pressure on the Premier League to tell them that they can't play there, then you can't play in the World Cup either. You know, I mean, theoretically, that is a leverage. That is a leverage that they would have, right? Maybe it's just being cynical. I still think that this is a big muscle flexing power play for them to get either a better deal from UEFA, better deal for the big clubs, which means just more money for them from the Champions League, more leverage over whatever the new format is, possibly even something akin to what happened in basketball 20 years ago, where obviously they did break away and they did face sanctions. And then they ended up forming the EuroLeague and kind of sort of bent basketball to or European basketball. They kind of bent it back to their will with licenses and whatever. I think this is posturing. And I would love it if somebody called their bluff. Because I'll tell you what, and this is the part that has never made sense to me. So first of all, if you're a Premier League club, if you're one of those six clubs, yeah, you could always use more money, but do you really want to go down that road? Are you really that concerned about it when ultimately you're on fairly solid ground with the Premier League? And if you can negotiate better terms with yourself for yourself internally, think of Project Big Picture, then you might be okay there. But secondly, the part I don't understand is I can see why this makes a ton of sense if you're a Glazer, if you're FSG who own Liverpool, because, you know, ultimately, you're a businessman, right? The value of your club will appreciate and you can sell it for more money and you'll make more money. And if you're losing money, you'll stop losing money. But what is the appeal of this to Real Madrid or to Barcelona or to Bayern? These guys, you know, they don't make money if their club's books look better. They don't make money when their club makes money. They can't sell their clubs. All they can do is be stewards of their clubs. And if you go from a team that wins titles every year to a team that finishes mid-table in a breakaway Super League and maybe can't even play in their domestic league, is this really as appealing? So I think that's where the battle's going to be, is going to be fought. Can you have some breakaway entity? And again, I probably mirroring what happened in basketball with the EuroLeague, where you can still play domestically. So you can still say, oh, well, it's okay, because, you know, we finished 18th out of 32 teams in the Super League. But look, you know, we won the Copa del Rey or we won the Bundesliga. So you can keep selling your success to the fans. Or if they hold fast on that, if FIFA have enough leverage to get the actual individual leagues, like, no domestic football for you if you go down that route, then I think it becomes untenable. So it's an interesting scenario. I always thought this was more likely to happen if FIFA were, you know, even behind the scenes on board with the clubs. If they're not, if FIFA are going to align themselves with the confederations, I think it's going to be really, really tough.
Well, I think that is the key to this. You raised so many great points there, but I mentioned a second ago the politics of Infantino. I think it's no secret that he has always wanted FIFA to have a second revenue generator as opposed to the World Cup, in addition to the World Cup. And he's got his eyes on club football. Every attempt he's made to do that with the World Cup championships have been a disaster. And, you know, if we wind the tape back 6 months, he was very much in bed with the Super League and the private equity boys. The story today is not really Super League, will it happen, will it not happen? It's why has Gianni changed horses on this? And is it because he's got somebody else to back his World Club competition or not? That one, I think, will play out by the time this goes out in a week. But you know, coming back to what you say about the Spanish teams and the German teams, the reason that they like the Super League is that today, I think they're at a competitive disadvantage to the Premiership clubs who have got more revenues. They believe they shouldn't be at that disadvantage, and they like the level playing field that a Super League would develop. The other thing I think, Gab, is that I really do believe this, and you look at the change in the logo of Juventus, you look at all the ways that they're moving to lifestyle brands, all the mood music around that. They believe that they are entertainment companies and they just do not want volatility. You can't run with the volatility of not getting in the Champions League or, heaven forbid, getting relegated. So it's a transition to football becoming Disney or something, or Marvel or something like that. And I'm not sure people have realized the strength yet of the market forces moving us towards content and entertainment.
I think that's a really strong point you make. I think it's something that, you know, certain people, certain visionaries have been talking about for 20, 25 years. I think if you remember the original incarnation of MUTV, where they were just going to, not sure television was going to become sort of some new generalist channel with cooking shows and whatever else all around the United brand. That didn't work, and maybe it came too early. I think there's a lot to be said for that, but I'd also caution that, first of all, brands have to be cool. And you're not just cool. I mean, people have done studies on this. You know, I may be a huge Liverpool fan, but if their shirt looks like rubbish, I'm not necessarily going to want to walk around with a Liverpool logo. Or even in the case of Juventus, yes, you have a much more presentable logo. But if you start selling me tat, I'm not necessarily going to buy into that lifestyle. I think making products that people want to buy is extremely difficult. And you don't just get there with branding. Certain people have succeeded at it. I mean, none of you guys look like people who are probably who own Supreme gear, but you might have kids or nephews who do, you know, so obviously that kind of stuff, some people can crack it. But, you know, how much faith do we have that, you know, Ed Woodward will hire the right people to make something that people want to buy? I don't know.
And this is a kind of what I was keen to delve into, is that at the heart of all sport, but at the heart of commercial sport, lies the humble fan, the individual unit that is then multiplied into value. And I wonder whether your earlier points about the gates being opened of football clubs, we've seen in COVID, we've had this extraordinary time where we've seen sport without fans, or not present, without the atmosphere. And we've all noticed that there's something missing. No shit, Sherlock, there is something missing. There's lots of people. But it's had an effect. It's had an effect both on the performance, but also on the soul. And I wonder, as we're talking about big highfalutin ideas, which may be good for the, as you say, for the groups looking to monetize their investment. But I suspect, once again, the shortchanged are the fan, who won't get their passion point, because to Grant's point right at the top of the show is, he's a Fulham fan. He doesn't have a choice in that, but he'll take the highs and the lows because that is the fan journey. And Disneyfication, I don't buy it, because it's not a packaged product, because with Disney and with that kind of content, the storyline is predetermined. With sport, it isn't. And that's the magic of sport.
You're right. It's entirely unscripted. And I'll be careful, because you guys both mentioned Disney. Disney, of course, are my employers.
I'm seeing it in a positive.
Obviously, they've been very good.
Plus, in Scotland, it mean doesn't. I think we can get away with that, Rog, right?
But I think that ties back to my previous point, right? They're good at making things that Disney are good at making extremely things good. That people want. Maybe because, you know, there is a script. It doesn't, you know, that doesn't end with some sort of jarring ending. You know, no matter what you're doing, you know, it's not like, you know, Elsa all of a sudden takes a chainsaw out and starts chopping everybody to pieces at the end of Frozen, right? So like you're not let down by it. You know, it's not everything is as good as everything else, but it's generally not shit and people want to buy it. Do football clubs know how to do that? You know, I was reading about
it. They will eventually, Gab. They will eventually. Will they?
I don't know.
I think so.
Okay, so my best friend works for an American company called Untuck It. And this might seem silly to you, and it seems silly to me at first, but they started a few years ago, and the founder said, well, in summer, we like to wear our shirts untucked, our button-down shirts. And button-down shirts aren't designed to be worn untucked, and so they don't hang properly. They're too long, or they hang funny. So let's design shirts which are meant to be worn untucked. You know, and thereby capitalizing on the fact that there's a lot of men in their 40s who wear their shirts untucked because they don't really have a choice, right? So if we make some smart shirts, and then we can sell them, and we'll brand ourselves as a premium product and sell them at $80 to $100 a shirt, let's see if this works. And they became a resounding success, but they had to put a lot of money into it, a ton of money into marketing to be able to do that, to be able to establish their brands. Now, I know Juventus to have channels, right? And yes, they can co-brand with somebody else. But I'm just imagining Juventus trying to come up with like a serious line of apparel that could become, for example, a serious apparel brand. And could they justify the kind of investment, the kind of trial and error that is necessary to do that? Especially given that they run a football club, and it's like, wait, you're spending $10 on this rather than spending it on Cristiano Ronaldo or whatever. I don't know. I think it's a big ask. And the fact that nobody's done it successfully. A few years ago, you guys might remember this, the guy who owns Lyon, Olas, he started a cab company in Lyon, right? With all these cabs that were OL branded colors to compete with the whatever local cabs or car service was. I don't know if that's still around. I don't know if he made much money out of it. That seems like something's commodity, but then after a while, aren't you going to become price sensitive? And aren't you going to compete based on price if it is that sort of thing that's actually useful? So I don't know what the answer is. I mean, Monaco as well tried to pitch themselves as a luxury brand in football, and they had a whole grand plan there.
And well, and I would say as a brand guy as well, and someone who's studied history as well, is that not only is sport the best sport, it's unscripted, but very often it's shit script, which is actually how the heritage of the brand things go wrong. I.e., it's the highs and the lows that creates the mystique and the magic of a brand. It's not just the good times. You have to have suffered the low to appreciate the high, and I think fans understand that.
I think that's a great point. I think that's been part of the narrative. I think that's how underachieving clubs have sold themselves for years and years and years, right? You know, Tottenham haven't won the league since 1961 and whatever else. And the nice thing about sport is that there's something for everybody. If you support Fulham, you will be just as excited about the time you knocked out Juventus, you know, as a Bayern fan winning the fifth of their eight consecutive titles or whatever it is, right? I think that's important. And I think that is something, though, that, I mean, I've talked about the dangers of polarization endlessly. It's just one of my pet themes. As sort of the aggregate mass of football fans grows, because we add fans in Asia, we're adding fans, but not just in Asia. You see it here in England or in Italy as well, right? If you're a Rochdale fan, right? Unless you're fortunate enough to have a family member who takes you to watch Rochdale at home on weekends, and increasingly that might not be possible because people work on weekends, or you might have other commitments or whatever, and it still costs money. Are you going to be a Rochdale fan, or are you going to be a Manchester United fan when they're on, you know, every single game virtually is on television, or a Man City fan because they're actually good and they win, you know, and you're going to watch some League Two club and you're like, what the hell is this? Why am I here? You know, and as the percentage of people who support, you know, giant clubs grows in the aggregate mass of football fans, I think you will get a different dynamic. And I think that could accelerate perhaps what Roger's talking about. And then we'll lose the idea that you were talking about before, which is, you know, this idea of the lows with the highs.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, we've talked about this before on the show, but that superb Netflix documentary, Sunderland Till I Die, was so illustrative to me, because when you watch Series 1 and at the end, obviously, it's all gloom and doom and the club's in disaster and the fans are complaining about everything and bitching and moaning about the owners and obviously, woe is us. And then, you know, we all step out of that story. We step out of it for 8, 9, 10 months until Season 2 comes back. Season 2 comes back and the first episode was these same fans talking about how I can't wait for the season to start and they can't wait to see the team again. And that, I think, for me, that wraps up this whole conversation we've had, talking about this, the choice that you aren't presented with as a fan, the ability of clubs to tap into that and realize that you do have a captive audience. And I think your point about these lifestyle brands, Gab, you and Rog, I think the one problem I have there with your view of this, Rog, and I kind of tend towards Gab, is that if you're a Juventus lifestyle brand, well, you've instantly alienated anyone in Milan from ever buying anything of yours that they're going to put on their back. And anyone from other places all around Italy, simply because it's Juventus. Yes, there will be people in Milan, but you know, anyone that has a football soul will, there's no scouser that's going to put on a Man United lifestyle brand shirt, no matter how great it looks, no matter how unobscure the logo is. So I think, you know, this conversation has been absolutely fascinating to me in so many ways, Gabby. And, you know, we can't thank you enough for joining us.
No problem. Isn't that the reason, incidentally, I remember how weird it was that Rangers and Celtic always had the same sponsor on their shirts? Isn't that fundamentally the reason why?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
So, and to that, I mean, you know more with sponsors, but you don't want to compete against your sponsors either, right? I mean, surely that comes into it at some point as well. If you become a lifestyle brand and you're offering a whole suite of different products, then obviously those are all sponsors who you won't be working with, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, fortunately, these days all the companies that sponsor them are either crypto companies or betting companies.
Yeah, so exactly.
That makes the whole thing a lot easier.
But by the way, sorry, one of the things you mentioned this, just because this has always bugged me, right, about betting companies. There's two clubs in the Premier League. I think it's Wolves and somebody else. For some reason, I noticed these stupid betting company names. And one of them is sponsored by something called Man Bet. Have you seen this?
I think it's Man Bet. Yeah.
Who would think that this is a good idea? It sounds like Grindr or something. Like who would think that this is a good idea to call my betting company Man Bet?
Well, you say that. Guys I know knew a guy years ago whose name was Wayne Bruce, and his nickname was Man Bat, for obvious reasons, which I always love. So whenever I see that Man Bat shirt, I'm thinking of Bat rather than what he's. But you're absolutely right.
Brilliant.
Gav, listen, thank you so much. You've given us so much of your time.
Thank you,
Gav. It's been an absolute joy. Just let people know who don't follow you, how they can do that and where they can read more of your stuff.
Yeah, so I work for ESPN, so they can find my writing on ESPN.com. I appear on the ESPN FC show, which is licensed around the world. We also, clips go on YouTube. And then I have my own baby of a podcast together with my colleague Julian Lawrence called The Gab and Jules Show. It's twice a week, Monday and Thursday. And if you can't stay across all of football around Europe, the big clubs, big stories, we kind of do it for you and provide a bit of added commentary as well.
Little too light on the Fulham for my liking, Gab, but I'm going to continue listening anyway.
Like I said, the big brands, the big stories, we're driven by metrics too.
There we go. There we go. All the hypocrites. It's the big ones that count.
Gab, thank you so much.
Talk about it for an hour other than it. Thanks,
Gab. Take care, guys. Have a good one.
Cheers.
Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Oh, that was fabulous. What a wonderful conversation.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting, isn't it, to talking to, the perspectives we're fortunate enough to get on the show, from private equity down to journalists, down to fans. And it's so interesting how when you sit in the middle like we do and you get the ability to see sport as a 360 holistic and these different vectors that come at you from different angles, everyone's speaking the same language, but they can't all kind of coexist in the same blissful little universe for all the pressures that Gab highlighted so beautifully there.
Yeah, one thing I would say, listen, you're right. You know, we're so fortunate to have everybody come on and share these views. He was very open at the start about journalism, maybe a take that people didn't expect. The one thing I would just say about your point, Grant, about Sunderland till I die and they're all back. Fact is, not all of them are back, Grant. They're fucking dying. They're dying off, those ones. And that's why you get an average age at baseball of whatever it is. There is a need to attract the people who will replace the ones that die in a cold snap.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
So that's why I know I always come across as this corporate devil that, you know, I'm just telling you, they are not attracted to all the rationales that we often hear about. And, you know, you saw this week, you know, Fortnite and the clubs have done a deal, and that's the way it needs to go. The reason I like all our shows is because we have different perspectives, as you say. People come on, say different things, and if they are smart, and they always are on our show, it just makes you think. You know, that's what I... You know, I never said almost anything in the first half of the show because I was just reflecting, didn't want to interrupt. And I was, well, it's great. And I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, really, and was. Also just to get the view of the perspective of the fan, any sport was always going to lure me in with a decent cheeseburger and fries. So when that comes back, I'll be straight back in, don't care what the sport is.
Well, look, all that remains, as always at this point in the proceedings, is to thank, first of all, our wonderful sponsors, PumpCheck Dataworks, for supporting the show as they do, and to you, our listeners, for listening to the podcast and giving us this platform and hopefully enjoying these conversations as much as we do. Please, please, please do take a moment, if you wouldn't mind, to rate and review us on the iTunes Store. It helps, as I remind you every week. My thanks to my co-hosts, Roger and Giles, and our wonderful producer, Jimmy the Greek, here in the Cayman Islands with me. It's been a pleasure. As always, gentlemen, what do you say we do it again next week?
Sounds good for me.
Perfect.
Between now and next time, if you want to follow us on Twitter, you'll find us, as always, sitting there quietly at Entertained R. That's the word, A-R-E. You'll find me sitting there quietly at T-T-M-Y-G-H.
And you'll find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
And of course, I'm not allowed to be quiet there now that I'm one of the top sports influencers, but I will be at RPM Como, as always, as in the lake.
As in the lake. And Roger, if you ever go quiet on us, God knows what's going to happen to the rest of the world. So you keep going, my friend. Until next time, gents.
Take care, lads. Thanks. Right.